As the Senate gets ready to vote on the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, the country continues to focus on the allegations of sexual assault that have roiled his nomination. Today, we talk to college students about if this national focus has changed their on-campus conversations around consent. Also, do you remember visiting your school nurse when you were a kid? These days, half of Illinois schools don't have one. We'll talk about how they're coping. Plus, this week, the Cubs lost to the Rockies and missed the playoffs, and that's a disappointment for a team that's getting used to real success. Here's Cubs manager Joe Maddon on MLB's YouTube channel.
It is disappointing because our anticipation, our expectation is to play the last game of the year and win it. We had a lot of things go awry. I mean, there's, I'm not going to stand here and sit here and number them.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, with national attention so focused on the issue of sexual assault, we'll talk with a few college students about the conversations they're having about healthy sexual conduct on their campus. Has the past year of the Me Too movement changed that conversation? Also, we'll be wrapping up the Cubs season. Sorry, Cubs fans, but we're also going to be talking about the Chicago Bears just getting started. We could look forward to that. But first, think back to when you were in school. Do you remember visiting the nurse? You might not know that more than half of schools in Illinois don't have a nurse. This sounds problematic when you're thinking about the number of scrapes and bruises and colds and fevers that students get. But what about when you consider all of the other mental and physical health services that children rely on at their schools nowadays? Earlier this week, we talked about the growing amount of anxiety that young people are experiencing with Dr. Geeta Maker-Clark. We've also talked about how schools can serve as a hub for healthcare and nutrition, especially in our rural areas. And so nurses do so much more than just give ice packs, but there aren't enough of them. So we've assembled a few folks to talk about this issue. Linda Vollinger is the head of the Illinois Association of School Nurses. She's also a nurse at Stagg High School in Palos Hills. It's a southwest suburb of Chicago. Mary Fisher is the health services coordinator for Rockford Public Schools. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
And for those of you who are listening to the conversation, you're always welcome to join us, especially if you're in a district that doesn't have a school nurse, or maybe you have a nurse at your school that you love that you want to tell us about. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. Linda, before we get to talking about the needs as well as the deficits with the situation, I just wanted to ask you what the typical training is for a school nurse.
School nurses in Illinois have to have at least a bachelor's degree in nursing. They're registered nurses, and then to hold a professional educator license through the State Board of Education requires graduate coursework beyond that bachelor's degree in nursing, and then taking a content exam to pass, similar to, you know, what teachers take to be certified in their specialty area. So there's two programs in the state of Illinois. One is at Lewis University, and the other is at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And they're online programs that work with RNs, registered nurses with a bachelor's degree in nursing, who want to go on and get that specialty certification in school nursing.
And is that the case no matter what age the student is, Linda, that they have to have that certification?
There are schools that have just registered a registered nurse. They don't have that Illinois educator licensure. For special education evaluations and health assessments and recommendations, that educator certification, professional educator license status is required.
And Mary Fisher, you've worked in Rockford Public Schools, is it for almost 25 years?
Yes, I have.
And with all those different ages for the district's many schools, how does that work?
Well, we provide an orientation for any of our new employees. Either they start out as non-certified registered nurses and go through our orientation in that manner, and then if they become certified, then we also have a post-certification orientation where they're hooked up with a mentor, at least for the first year. And then, of course, you develop those relationships and continue to ask questions of your mentor throughout the years as they go by.
And so, Mary, when we have a sense of Rockford Public Schools, I'm not sure exactly how many schools are in the district, but how many nurses are you working with?
We have about 50 schools in our district and 29,000 students. And our staffing ratio is really quite nice, actually. We have about 32 certified nurse positions and about 23 non-certified RNs that work in our district.
And Linda, when the Illinois Association of School Nurses looks at populations, is there an ideal ratio of student population to nurses that the association would like to see?
Nationally, the National Association of School Nurses had recommended one nurse for every 750 regular education students, and then one nurse to every 200 or 250 special education designated students. They've kind of gotten away with, you know, having a number because it's, you also have to look at acuity or severity of the health issues that you're dealing with. So to just kind of quantify it with a number doesn't always give you the, you know, the service that you need.
Or the sense of the coverage, right? And so, Mary,
right,
when we're thinking about the severity of things, what kind of reasons, what kind of health problems are we seeing children visit school nurses for?
Anything imaginable. We can have a student who may walk into our office that has a loose tooth, you know, standard loose tooth for their age. We have well over 100 students that carry a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. Any injury or fall on the playground, they may come in with a head injury or an abrasion, a broken arm or a suspected fracture, just a simple headache from either thinking too much, not having enough breakfast, not having enough fluids, or maybe they didn't sleep good the night before. So it's really a sense of triaging all day, every day, anything that comes into that health office. And, of course, you're looked to handle whatever it is that walks in.
And Linda, what about for you at Stag Hills High School? I mentioned that's just outside of Chicago. You serve one school. It's a big one. What's a typical day like for you?
Well, as Mary said, it's never the same, and you really are, you know, need to be prepared for anything. It could run the gamut of, you know, a diabetic having a low or high blood sugar and needing assistance, seizures. It could be you know, anything to do with, you know, vaping is a new, you know, we're seeing a lot in the adolescent population, not just here at Stag, but just across the country.
And are they allowed is that allowed in school? Are they allowed to bring vaping devices?
No. So it would be similar to as if, you know, we treat it the same way as tobacco use. They're not, you know, they're not of age to even be carrying that. They can't have it on campus. So we do, you know, we'll assess them and work with them, you know, to give them, you know, resources to follow up within the community and depending on, you know, the severity or what it is that they're vaping. And a lot of times that what's scary is the kids don't know what's in there. But that we also will see, you know, other things in the office we'll see are, you know, PE injuries, falls, concussions between athletes and non-athletes. So any student with a concussion has to be monitored by state law. So we work closely with our athletic training staff, with our athletes, and then we also, like I said, any student with a concussion has to be monitored per the concussion protocol. So it's, as Mary said, it's triaging everything that comes in the door. And no day is the same.
And I imagine it's not just physical, but also mental health needs. I wonder how often, particularly when we're thinking about high school, how much you all serve as a safe space for students to come with all kinds of problems?
We do. In our school, we have a space in the nurse's office that's kind of a little bit quieter. You know, lighting is different, furniture is different. It's just a place for them to decompress and kind of regroup. We also will pull in other team members, whether it's the social worker, the school counselor, the psychologist, and just have a full wraparound approach with students. And, you know, the students that don't have identified mental health issues are, you know, that's a little bit trickier because a lot of times those are the students that are coming in with kind of benign complaints, or so it would seem, where, you know, complaints of headache, nausea, stomach ache, just not feeling well. And as you sit with them and talk to them, you build relationships with them, you learn, you can tease out what the problem is. It could be that, you know, something's going on at home that the school is not aware of until, you know, talking to the student, it comes out. It could be just, you know, the stress of being a teenager and being a high school student and worried about grades and trying to juggle, you know, work, their extracurricular activities, their academics. So those students that come in with kind of those, you know, vague complaints are the ones that, you know, we really try to hone in on even more so to make sure that there isn't an underlying issue that we're missing.
That's Linda Volinger. She's head of the Illinois Association of School Nurses. She's also a nurse at Stagg High School in Palos Hills. Mary Fisher is also on the line with us from Rockford, where she's the health service coordinator. Mary, how often, when it comes to mental health, as we're hearing Linda describe this, how closely is it that nurses are able to work with other staff like social workers? Are there cases where nurses are the only available option, Mary?
Oh, absolutely. Everything that Linda talked about is absolutely true, and I think one of the challenges, the biggest challenges of our job, is to try to squeeze out what is a mental health issue for the student and what is real life. You know, it's easy to see a crooked arm that you might suspect is broken, but how do you know that that child who's complaining of a stomach ache or a headache didn't have just a terrible night taking care of a parent during the night, throughout the night, or didn't sleep, was taking care of a sibling, et cetera. So I see all of that as one of our greatest challenges. And then if we see that there's a potential for a mental health issue, where do we find the staff that is available to help, you know, get that child through that crisis, if you will? Sometimes it is just a matter of letting them sit quietly, letting them regroup for a minute, but other times it may be a long-term issue that they need to have guidance getting through.
And Linda, what happens across the state? It's not mandated that districts have nurses, right? So what happens in areas where there aren't any?
Well, and that's the scarier part of it, because a lot of times if there isn't a nurse in the health office, it could be a secretary, it could be an administrator, it's a non-health professional that's trying to navigate that, you know, the healthcare world within the school setting. So a lot of times, you know, they err on the side of caution, they'll send the student home, or, you know, they just aren't identifying the issues. And I know in the southern parts, more rural areas, you know, nurses are covering counties. They're not just covering one school district.
They're covering an entire county. Wow.
Across an entire county. So that, you know, they may be at one school one day, another the next. So that's really a huge challenge, and it's a huge stressor for nurses throughout the state.
And Mary, when we think about other challenges as well, when we talk about a shortage, I imagine there's also, is there interest from nursing students? I wonder how much school nursing positions pay compared to other nursing jobs.
The certified nurses that are on our staff are also under the pay scale of our teachers' union. So that would be anywhere from, I'm just going to throw out a number, like $25,000 a year, all the way up to $80,000 a year, depending on your education level, how many graduate credits you have beyond the highest degree you have, and then how many years you've been at your profession. So that might compare to a hospital nurse who's making $25 an hour to start
oh, wow.
at,
yeah.
but is working a 2,000-hour work year. We have about 130 student nurses that come through a clinical rotation through our district every year. So as part of their community rotation, they have a day that they experience the life of a school nurse. So we try as hard as we can to show them the challenges that we enjoy every day, the students that we might see, the variety of whatever walks in our door, and hope that we can capture some of those nurses when they're ready to come into our profession.
Let's go to really quickly, if we can. We've got a caller. Karma Lynn is on the line from Decatur. Karma, we're almost out of time, but can you ask your question quickly so we can, Linda and Mary can answer?
I can. I just wonder if the School Nurse Association can recruit from the pool of licensed clinical social workers that could easily do an MSN. I know Millikan University can take people with LCSW and turn them into an MSN. Is that a career ladder? And I can take my answer off air.
Thanks, Karma. Linda?
There would also have to be, they would get the MSN, but they would also have to go through, include the professional educator license coursework in school nursing. That's something that we haven't really looked into. I know there's other bachelor's degrees, folks that will, from another profession with a bachelor's degree, will also want to go into the nursing field. So they, I think, almost have an accelerated content or curriculum from the bachelor's program, and then they go into the master's program.
So it's an interesting option, possibly, right?
Right. They would still have to be, obviously earn their master's in nursing and then the coursework in the school nursing specialty, and then, take the RN licensure as well.
Mm. Well, thanks for at least us. Maybe we've had a chance to understand a little bit about the problem and some of the solutions. Thanks, Carmelin, for your call. I want to thank Linda Vollinger with the Illinois Association of School Nurses. She's also a nurse at Stagg High School in Palos Hills. Mary Fisher with the Rockford Public Schools, where she's a health service coordinator. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Gordon.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Senate is scheduled to convene tomorrow on the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. His hearings and the numerous sexual assault allegations lodged against him have prompted a national conversation about consent in the culture at college campuses. But this isn't a new conversation. Think back to movements like Take Back the Night, which dates back to the 70s and hit a peak in the late 90s. But what are today's college students talking about when it comes to healthy sexual conduct? First, consider the stats. Across the country, a quarter of undergraduate women experience some kind of rape or sexual assault on campus. Here where we broadcast from at the University of Illinois, according to the Champaign News Gazette, there were about 50 cases of harassment, dating violence, and sexual assault that were investigated by the university in 2016 and 2017. That's nearly double from 2016 and 2014. Joining me now, though, are a few of the many students that are leading these conversations. Sudarshana Rao is the Vice President for Students Against Sexual Assault at the University of Illinois. She also facilitates various sexual education and bystander intervention programs on campus, where she's a junior studying economics. Connor Riddle is a risk manager for the Interfraternity Council that works with Greek organizations on the U of I campus, which helps all organizations adhere to policies. He's also a senior studying molecular cell biology. And Jaya Colasetti is also with us. She's the Associate Director for the Rape Advocacy Counseling and Education Services. Those in Central Illinois might know the acronym better by RACES. She's a supervisor for their prevention education programs. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sudarshan, I wanted to just start with you. As so many, I feel like this is a conversation that's happening all across the country. As the vice president of Students Against Sexual Assault on Campus, I know this is an issue that's really important to you. I wonder how it feels now to have all of these news stories about a topic that's really important to you.
I feel like, especially with the Me Too campaign, I feel happy that people are feeling empowered to come out, but I'm also feeling angry that there's so many cases still going on. But then again, it's all, yeah.
No, it's a lot. Did you watch that? Did you watch the hearings last week?
I did watch the hearings last week. It was so angering just to see that all the questions they were asking her and like all the comments afterwards and everything on social media. It was just so overwhelming.
What kind of conversations are people having on campus about it?
On campus? I think that, so last week we had kind of a healing space with Students Against Sexual Assault where people could just come through and talk about like how they're feeling about the whole Kavanaugh situation. And I think most people were just very angry that this person is being considered for a Supreme Court justice while having this record.
Connor, we've been learning a lot about Brett Kavanaugh's past, both in high school and college, and particularly his experience drinking and his relationship with his fraternity. And I should note to our audience, we reached out to a lot of different Greek organizations at the University of Illinois and Bradley University, including Brett Kavanaugh's former fraternity, the local Deke chapter, and they declined to join us. So we appreciate you coming on. I wonder, when we think about just the conversations that are happening with the fraternities and sororities that you're in contact with on campus, are they talking about this too?
Well, we've been talking about this for several years now. Well, we started an initiative about 3 years ago to kind of advance this conversation. Right now, with the Kavanaugh case, I would say that it's promoted further conversation. But again, we've been taking action for several years now.
And so what would you want people to know about, quote unquote, I think, frat culture, because we've been hearing so much about that in the news, too.
Yeah, it's easy to hear about frat culture because, unfortunately, the negatives are what tends to hit the news. Here on campus, we try to promote fraternity culture. Pretty much the
opposite.
What's
the different, yeah?
I guess frat culture would be how apparently the media would report us. In negative situations where individuals make bad choices. Fraternity culture is where we try to promote our values and we try to live up to certain standards that we try to adhere as gentlemen or as ladies of the Panhellenic Council.
And so you're actually a risk manager. Can you explain what that job is? Because some people might have never heard of this before.
Yeah, so there are 9 members on our executive board. Me overseeing the risk management, I oversee the all social events on campus regarding both the Interfraternity Council and the Panhellenic Council. So that means that every chapter has to register their social events for the week with myself and my counterpart in the Panhellenic Council. And then we organize observers to go to those events to make sure that they're up to policy and making sure that the overall safety of the event is adequate.
And so when the policy, does that involve, so that involves having a certain number of people at parties or other events that are sober? Is that how it works?
That's right. We require 3 sober monitors per event. It doesn't matter how big the event is. Typically, especially with sororities, we see many more than that, according to their own national policies.
Jaya, what about the role of alcohol? Because I think that's also been part of the national conversation. And I just wanted to ask you about what role you think that plays in the prevalence of sexual assault or misconduct.
So I think the conversation around alcohol is so complicated because so often we hear people have this idea that if someone has been drinking that they've somehow consented. And when we talk about consent, part of what consent is that it's informed, right? So someone needs to know what they're saying yes or no to when we're talking about any kind of sexual behavior. So if someone is so intoxicated that they don't know what they're being asked or they might be incapacitated, clearly they can't give consent. And I think that's an important piece. I think another part of it that's important to think about and talk about is the fact that alcohol is frequently used by people who commit sexual assault to facilitate assaults, right? It might make it more difficult for someone to resist an assault. It might make it so they have fragmented memories. And the impact of that on survivors can be really profound, too. If people don't remember part of what happened, aren't sure, you know, what role alcohol played, that can be really complicated for folks. And I think it, again, is just so important for people to recognize that someone consenting to drink does not mean that they are consenting to sexual activity. And it's really important that we're supporting folks and recognizing that people have a right to drink and not have something happen to them.
And I wonder if we could talk about consent for a moment. Sudarshana, what kind of work do you do to encourage fellow students to have conversations about this, to even define what consent means. Does this start when people are freshmen and they come onto campus, right?
Yes. So I'm one of the facilitators for the FICARE program at the university. And FICARE stands for First Year Campus Acquaintance Rape Education Program. And so University of Illinois is actually one of the only schools that has a mandated sexual assault prevention program for undergraduates. And every first-year student has to take a FICARE workshop, and I'm one of the facilitators for it. And during this workshop, we talk about lots of different things, including what consent is, how to ask for consent, how to support survivors and be a bystander. So we talk about that, and every freshman is supposed to take that workshop.
And Connor, you freshmen also in fraternities and sororities are also have similar programs to FICARE as well, right?
That's right. The executive board before mine mandated a program called ICARE, which is for sexual assault bystander awareness. And this is required for all second year fraternity men. And this, again, specifies more so or talks about how we what to look for and how to interact, how to intervene if needed, those kind of things.
Now, so what kind of things are you looking for then? How do you teach people to be bystanders that are helpful in situations like this?
So the program basically shows people that if you see something out of the ordinary, such as maybe a guy giving a girl an excessive amount of drinks, maybe they aren't on the same intoxication level, those are obvious signs that something's wrong. And it talks further about how to deal with it, whether that be I go up to someone and say, cut it out, or maybe I get an employee at a bar if needed, or maybe I go and find her friends, point out to them the issue, and hopefully they take care of it.
And do you feel like that message has percolated throughout the Hellenic organization culture at the U of I? Do you feel like people are getting that message?
Yeah, I think we're much more aware of the issue now over the last few years than we've ever been before. And I think it's more common to not be afraid to say something if you see something out of the ordinary, which we're very grateful for.
Sudarshana, do you feel that way too?
Yes, I definitely do.
So when we think about the whole idea of having a conversation about consent, I wonder how often this is something that seems like people think this is difficult to ask for. Maybe this is like a mood killer to have a conversation about consent, assuming that both people are be able to have like not super intoxicated conversations about this. What do you say to people to respond to that?
So during the FICARE workshop, there is an actual section where we ask them, do you think asking for consent will kill the mood? And so many of them say yes, it will kill the mood. So in response, I'm like, how can we troubleshoot that then? What are some better ways to ask? What are some sexier ways to ask? And usually get some giggles from the audience because, you know, we're talking about sex now, they giggle. But then we kind of come up with some better ways to ask, because I think in a lot of people's heads, consent is this stiff, rigid thing that doesn't make things fun. So I think that once you give people the actual tools to be able to ask, I think that they're more receptive to it.
Do you guys feel that college students are better at having these conversations now than probably other adults are?
I would agree. I think because we're talking about it within our own culture more, that it's now acceptable to know what other people want.
Jaya, I wanted to ask you, you supervise workshops for educating people against sexual violence. These are geared, you do all levels, all ages, particularly when we're talking about young people or teenagers. I imagine at that age, this can also be a challenging conversation. How does that contribute to conversations to prepare young people before they get to college?
Yeah, I think that talking to younger folks is so incredibly important so that it's not people coming to college and then suddenly hearing the word consent for the first time. And it can look really different. Of course, there are different strategies for different age groups. You know, the conversation that we're having with really young students focus more on their rights to their body, bodily autonomy, the right to say no, to tell a trusted adult if something is wrong. And then we move on to conversations about healthier relationships and kind of build from there. And I think it's so important that we're having those conversations earlier on to kind of change the culture and make it so it's not this uncomfortable thing where people are like, oh, it's awkward to talk about consent, but that it should be empowering. It should be exciting. People should be enthusiastic about it when we're talking about consenting to sexual activity.
And do you guys feel like this is something that happens here on the U of I campus at the when you're a freshman, or does it happen throughout all of the years that people are on campus?
Does what
happen? Suda, do you feel like all of these conversations about healthy sexual behavior, about consent, about awareness, about sexual assault?
I think they happen all throughout, like whether they know that's what they're talking about or not, because freshman year, of course, they have phi care. But then the other years, I think that the students, like, people naturally talk about their relationships with their friends, right? So they're talking about relationships and consent, even if they don't know it.
And Sudha, I wanted to go back to something that you said about how you were really angry. And I'm thinking about Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony. So many people watched it. I think there were 20 million Americans that were watching her testimony. And it might have been for a lot of people the first time maybe they heard a story like that. And I wanted to ask you about the work that you do when we're thinking about survivors and their stories, how you think we should be hearing those stories, how we can be more compassionate to people.
I think that, especially with the Me Too campaign, if people share their stories like on the internet or like they come forward and talk about their stories, I think that a good way to support them would just be like telling them, I believe you. And if they think it's their fault, tell them it's not their fault. Because I think the bottom line for anything is like survivors need to be believed, because that's one of the main concerns that they have. And they need to know that what happened was not their fault.
So, Connor, when we're thinking about these conversations, I wonder how you think the past year, particularly the Me Too movement, has, if it's changed any of the work that you've done, particularly when we're thinking about Greek organizations or Greek life.
The Me Too movement was a big part of, we held Stride for Survivors, all four Greek councils, which promotes, coming out as a survivor and how to support survivors. And it took a big part then, the Me Too movement. But again, it's one of those things that is helps promote the discussion of the topic on campus.
Do you think this is something that needs to be mandated?
Which part?
All of the education, just all of the education, all of the things that has happened. It seems like U of I has a lot of mandates for this.
I think so. Whenever I first came into college, phi care was kind of a big shock for me. And then over time, I gained more experience being social, what to look for. And then whenever I entered my sophomore year, obviously, then I learned more about just being more involved in my fraternity. I learned more about expectations. And then, again, once this eye care mandate was passed, I think it further educates people on what to look for.
Jay, as we're talking about this, do you think there are things, I should note to our audience that we reached out to multiple U of I staff who deal with this and they declined to join the conversation today, but is there more you think universities can be doing, the U of I or other universities, to promote this?
I think that, you know, making sure that students are aware of what resources are available to them on campus if something does happen, as well as resources in the community, is really important, because not everyone is necessarily going to be comfortable.
In your community group, we should
are.
Point out.
Yeah, so we serve four counties in East Central Illinois, but we're also part of a coalition, the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So there are community resource centers by every single college campus, and we have absolute privilege in terms of what's shared with us. Our confidentiality includes absolute privilege. So if there are people who are just wondering, what are my options? Who can I talk to? I don't want this to go beyond us. I think part of what's beneficial with the collaboration between universities and community centers is that there's a lot of that kind of information piece that we can do without violating people's confidentiality that universities might have a little bit more restrictions on.
That's a good point, and it's a good point for us to end on and remind everybody that if you are a survivor and if you need to talk to somebody, the National Sexual Assault Hotline number is 1-800-656-4673. That's 1-800-656-HOPE. Sudarshana, I want to thank you. I know you guys have an event later this month called with Students Against Sexual Assault. That's called It Happens Here. So we'll put that information on our website if people are interested. I want to thank Connor Riddle for being with us as well as Jaya Colasetti. Thanks, you guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Now it's time! The Colorado Rockies have gone on the road and defeated the Cubs to move on to the division series.
That's Matt Vasgersian on ESPN, and that unfortunately was the end of the Chicago Cubs season earlier this week. They lost 3-2 to the Rockies. Sorry, Cubs fans. We've given you an extra day to absorb this loss. This happened 2 days ago. I know this is a tough one. They at least made it to the playoffs, unlike the White Sox or the St. Louis Cardinals. There's also been more serious news in the world of baseball and for the Cubs. Yesterday, shortstop Addison Russell was sentenced to a 40-game suspension after an investigation into domestic abuse by the league. Now that baseball season is over in Chicago, the focus moves to the surprising 3-1 Bears, who are off this weekend. They're looking to get set up for a match against the Dolphins after their bye week. Also, the Blackhawks have a season opener tonight. The Bulls are also getting underway soon. This time of year, with all of the sports going on, we always love to talk about this with WBEZ's Cheryl Raystout. Hi, Cheryl. Good morning. Thanks for taking
the time to speak with us. Yeah. Thanks. It's interesting to be no baseball at this point.
It is. And I want to get to some of the Addison Russell news in a minute, but let's start with the Cubs that we played that final out from the wild card game. I wonder what Wrigley Field felt like when that game ended very late. It was the 13th inning. Am I right?
13th inning. Yes. I was still awake. Not in my pajamas yet. I was right outside. I was outside where we go in for the media, so I actually watched the fans left as soon as Colorado scored. They were leaving. They just kind of felt that they were that it was over with, and it was a very maudlin feeling. It was very it got quiet as soon as Colorado had that RBI. That was it, and you could feel it. And it kind of was that game was a microcosm of the season. They had terrific pitching, especially starter John Lester. And then they could not hit. There are times where they could not hit this season, and that game was just like that.
And as far as the season goes, I'm thinking about what manager Joe Maddon said at the postgame conference. He said a lot of things went awry. He said, I'm not going to sit here and number them. But I wonder, Cheryl, if you would mind sitting and number at least a few of them for us about what went wrong?
Well, couple things. To begin the season, they signed two free agent pitchers to be part of their starting rotation, Yu Darvish and Tyler Chatwood. Neither one of them worked out. Yu Darvish had an injury. He did not play. Tyler Chatwood could not pitch well. He got put in the bullpen and was forgotten about. That was a big deal. So then they also had the issues with injuries. With Chris Bryant, he missed 61 games this year. He was the heart of your lineup. He was a former MVP. He was not there. The other issue was the fact that they did not develop their young hitters, Ian Happ, Wilson Contreras, offensively. They did not develop well. So you had that problem. Now, there was a positive. Javi Baez had an MVP-type year, 34 home runs, 111 RBI. He had a great year, but a lot of the pieces weren't there, but they won 95 games. So Joe Maddon did a lot to move things around, get things to work right. He kept moving players around to try to get the right fit. That went well, but 95 wins, you should be able to win your division. They kind of were inconsistent at the end, and Milwaukee was much stronger at the end when you need to be, and that's why they're going on to the NLDS today.
Does it feel unusual for us to be talking about the Cubs, a wild card loss, a failure, I guess, when we consider the context of this season, the team over the decades?
You know what? I think Cub fans should be happy the way the team has been. This is a you know, the golden age of Cub play, and you can't. Is it a failure? I think for some people, but 95 wins, that's a great total to have. And I think right now people want to have more, which is good. It's better than being the lovable losers like they used to be.
Cheryl, so I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Cubs shortstop Addison Russell. Last month, his ex-wife, Melissa Reedy Russell, accused him of physically abusing her while they were still married. Yesterday, he was sentenced to a 40-game suspension. I wanted to play an interview that Melissa did with WGN, a little bit of it.
Even when you try and, like, explain to them, or when I try to explain to him, like, how that made me feel, it was like he did nothing wrong. And it happened because I did something.
That's Melissa Reedy Russell. For listeners who maybe have just heard about the story in passing, Cheryl, I wonder if you can walk us through the beginning of this, because this has been going on for more than a year.
Yeah, what happened was June of 2017, Melissa Reedy Russell's friend posted on Instagram that there was allegations of physical abuse by Addison Russell to his wife. At that point, the MLB did an investigation with him. What happened, we did not know until September 21st when Melissa wrote a blog detailing the allegations, was that she was going to start coming forward with this. Her divorce was final August 30th. With Addison. She was now cooperating with Major League Baseball. That is why he was suspended, because she was not talking for all this time. And once she was able to cooperate, that is why the suspension was put in place yesterday.
And what has Addison Russell said?
He had to agree to the suspension, but there's no admission of guilt as far as we have seen from him. He does not get paid during this period. We doubt that he'll be back in a Cub uniform after the suspension is over with.
Right. Has Theo Epstein, Cubs president, said anything about this?
When he was asked that yesterday at the press conference, he was asked, will he be back? He says, I don't know. I don't know is a pretty, it's a veil no in,
yeah,
in my
right.
View.
That's kind of a, it's not happening. Cheryl, when we as we just think about all of the, these conversations that we're having, in this case, this is a domestic abuse allegation that the league investigated. Is this different than how things were handled in the past? Do you think that this will be the end of his career now?
No, you know what? There's been 10 allegations of this type. It's 11. And now 9 of them have had suspension. All those players are back in baseball in some way, shape, or form. He will probably, because this is not a criminal, a decision by baseball and the union. I have to mention that this is an agreement that the union and Major League Baseball have together. Will he be back in baseball? Probably. It's, you know, the Cubs will either have to trade him or release him. I talked to a bunch of scouts. I said, well, what could happen? They said, you know, he could probably be with another team, but one scout said to me, if I were Addison Russell, I'd go to Japan for a while and play in Japan. So I don't know what's going to happen with him, but they do end up back in the game somehow, unlikely with the Cubs, because this is their second player that they've had on the team that's had some issues. They traded for Aroldis Chapman from the Yankees, who that year of 2016 was suspended earlier in the season for 30 games for shooting at his fiancée and choking her.
Oh, boy. It's obviously, I imagine, not something the franchise wants to have as part of the association with them, right? Cheryl.
Right. And I want to bring up one thing that Theo Epstein was talking about a lot yesterday. He was showing a lot of empathy towards Melissa. He also wants to offer help for her, and he wants Addison Russell to get help, too. Very much talked about how they want to make sure that the victims are taken care of during these situations.
Hmm. Let's move to the Chicago Bears. What people are saying up at Halas Hall, it's a bye week, a 3-1 start for the Bears. How good of a start of the season is this for the Bears?
This is the best start they've had in years. A lot of it has to do with the defense was very good going into the season, but once they traded for Khalil Mack, who was named the NFC Defensive Player of the Month today, that changed everything. That upped them even more. You have a new head coach in Matt Nagy, who is instilled a new offensive plan. He's gave the reins to starting quarterback Mitchell Trubisky, who had a great game just last Sunday against Tampa Bay. There's a lot of things working right. As long as injuries doesn't get in the way, this team could do very well this season.
Are you so you're feeling optimistic about the Bears this year, Cheryl?
Now that I got, you know, once you get to see them play, because I was at almost every training camp day. Once you see them actually play games and see things working, then you could see a real opening as to what this team can do this year. And I think they're going to be better than we thought they would. I thought maybe they'd be just over 500 or at 500. With the way they've played, they could be even better than that.
All right, we're going on a whirlwind tour through Illinois sports here because we've done baseball and we've done football. Let's move to hockey because the Hawks start their 2018 season in Ottawa tonight. What do the Blackhawks need to do, Cheryl, to come off of a very disappointing season last year? What are we thinking about this year?
They're considered underdogs again. And the problem they have is in their goaltending because of the concussion issues that Corey Crawford has sustained since last December 23rd and continues to try to come back. He is practicing with the team. It's a question mark. They are a question mark. There's no doubt about it. They are trying to fix their problems with the defensive side of their game, which they've infused with young players. They only have four core players left that, you know, has to try to instill the Hawk lore that they've had the last several years. It's going to be a struggle. And it's also going to be a struggle because Joel Quenneville is probably on the hot seat. That team has to perform in order for him to maybe retain his job.
Sure. Let's end with my favorite sport. Let's end with basketball. And I want to ask you about Jabari Parker joining the Bulls. How much of a surprise that is, how excited you are about having him on the team.
Well, Jabari Parker is kind of like the mystery man right now because, you know, we're talking about a guy that was a force when he played in high school and college, and Milwaukee took him as a top pick. But his knees, you know, caused him to miss a lot of time. He's the question mark because we don't know how he's going to fit in with this Bulls offense. One thing is with Lauri Markkanen went down. Lauri Markkanen was supposed to be the key offensive player, but he has the elbow injury. He's going to be out at least 6 to 8 weeks. And so Jabari Parker is going to have more of a role to play, and he's going to be very important. This is going to be a fun team to watch offensively, but defensively, not so good.
Cheryl, so Jabari Parker was a Simeon grad, right, from Chicago?
Yes, he was.
So what does it mean? I wonder what it means for when you have a Chicago high school kid coming back to play for the Bulls in the United Center. Does that change things at all?
Saw with Derrick Rose. Same school. It's a big deal. And the interesting thing, when his first preseason game, he had announced, you know, they usually announced the college. He said from Chicago. He's very, very happy to be able to play for Chicago. When I was at his press conference introducing him, his family was there. His high school coach was there. It was a big deal. Jabari Parker and his family are so ingrained into the community. They do a lot of philanthropic work. And so for Chicago, it's a big win. And for the Bulls, an even bigger win.
So when we're thinking about all of these sports, Cheryl, it's the fall. This is the time of year when all of the professional sports are kind of all convening, either coming or going. What are you most excited about?
You know, I wasn't excited about the Bears until I saw Mitchell Trubisky throw 6 touchdown passes the other day. I think that's the team that's really could be, you know, set everything on fire. And the Bulls will be second. But once Lauri Markkanen comes back, then they're going to be a much better team.
That's WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. Cheryl, always great to talk to you, to catch up on the sports world. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla. We'll be right back.
That does it for us today. Next week on the program, and actually coming up in a couple of weeks, we know as we approach the midterm elections, there's a big race going on in the 13th Congressional District. Lots of our listeners are in that area. I'm going to be moderating a debate between incumbent Congressman Rodney Davis and his opponent, the Democratic challenger, Betsy Dirksen Londrigan. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions that you'd like to ask during the debate, we are going to tweet out a link from the 21st show handle. We will have it at our website as well. But we're taking questions over the next 2 weeks. We'd love for you to shape our debate. All you have to do is send us an email or leave us a voicemail or make a video, and we're going to go through those questions, and maybe one of them will be asked during the debate. Again, that's coming up in 2 weeks, that 13th Congressional District debate that I'll be moderating. So we'd love, and I'd love, to have your participation in it. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Our website, as I mentioned, 21stshow.org, is the way to find past shows, our social media handles, and the way to leave us feedback. So just remember, 21stshow.org. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.